Hey, everybody, it's 1 o'clock, and if it's 1 o'clock on Tuesday, it must be Tuesdays with Dave. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the call today. It's been a very cold day up here in Boston. We got the winds howling. We had some snow over the weekend. But first of all, before I digress into that, I hope you all got a very good start off to the new year. Holidays are over. As I said last call, it's time to focus. I should have written down 2, 3, 4. Actually, you should be writing down 5 goals each year. 5, you know, big, hairy, audacious goals that you're going to be striving for. No more, no less. And then go for them. If you're not quite, if you want a little discipline on how to go for those goals, read a book called Rockefeller Habits. And it talks about the top 5s that I've been using now for many, many years. And it works really, really well. So if you haven't, I don't believe in New Year's resolutions, but I do believe in goal setting because goal setting certainly does work. It just keeps you focused on what you want to do. So it's cold. This morning it was so cold here in Boston, I saw a dog frozen to a hydrant. No joke. The winds are whipping. We had some snow for the first time this year over the night before. And it is probably about a 5 or 6 degree below wind chill factor out there. It's supposed to get a little bit colder tomorrow, which is okay because I'm flying down to Atlanta to take a look at some deals. So I guess I won't be out of the cold too much because I was talking to one of the sellers down there, and he said they're thinking about closing the schools in Atlanta because there's the hint of snow down there. So, but I'll tell you what, 32 degrees is a lot better than -5. So I'll be going down there in my shorts and my suntan oil. So that should be good. We haven't had much snow up here in New England this year. With that big storm going across the country, we'll get hit with a little bit of that. But that being said, we didn't have any snow last year up until this weekend coming up. And then we get snow for the next 7 weekends, and we set that record. So, hey, you know what? I always figure that everything is right in the world when the New England Patriots are winning. And they beat Kansas City over the weekend, which was great. We've got a big game on Sunday against Denver. See how that goes. And quite possibly back in the Super Bowl again. This is the 1-year anniversary of Deflategate, which was a bunch of crap anyways. So here we are, Tuesdays with Dave. This is where we have open lines. You get to ask any questions that you might have. Press *0. If you're new to the Mastery Program, welcome aboard. You made the right decision. We will take you step by step through the process of getting you into or helping you reach one of those top 5 goals, which I'm sure is the number of units that you want to own by the end of the year. But you press *0, operator's on the line. Operator will put you into the queue. Once you're in the queue, you'll be queued up to ask a question. So we do have some questions that came over via email. I want to give out some high fives. High five to Carl Withers and Ed Babanko. They just closed on 274 units, both mastery students, and rents were a value add, and they're going to do some rehab on that. I must say, since Carl's been with us now for about four and a half years, I believe that him and Ed, he got his partner Ed after his second deal from one of the boot camps. They met and they figured they were a pretty good fit. Ed's the numbers guy, Carl's the marketing guy. And they've been on a tear. I believe they're up to about 2,200 units right now. And they're doing really, really well. Carl was telling me that one of his properties that he bought at the very beginning has doubled in value. And he keeps getting calls from people that, you know, that want to buy his property, but he figures he's, you know, he's going to wait about another year or so, and then he'll look to sell. So that's pretty good. And Carl was the one, if you've ever heard me do that 90-minute presentation, and I say, you know, and here's Carl Withers. His wife said at the end of this the preview presentation, his wife said to him, she wasn't there, before he went, she said, if you buy another real estate course, I am going to divorce you. So he gets to the back table and he says, Dave, you know, my wife says she's going to divorce me if I buy another real estate program. That's why I'm paying you in cash. And he's done well since then. He actually bought his own airplane. And we were talking earlier today, talking about a deal that he has. And he now has his own management company. He has 2 regionals. He's got 12 property managers. He's got 12 properties now. 12 property managers. And things are going really, really well. Taking it step by step. Bill Johnson, just starting out, did 222 units. Don't have a lot of information on that because this Thursday I'm going to interview Bill on how they did that. And that will probably be played out, sent out the following Thursday on the Thursday email that we send out. So you get to see how exactly how Bill did that in his own words. And then mastery student Mark Schuler closed a, let me see here, 32-bedroom, one-bath units built in 1964. The average rent acquisition was $834. I don't understand a bunch of these numbers that come behind this, but Mark closed on his first 30-unit property, so Mark gets a big high five as well. So all three of those four people get high fives. Yeah. Got some questions here. And oh, I see what this is. Mark's deal is actually explained in about four paragraphs on what the value add was. He bought a D-plus property. Looks like he's going to be able to upgrade it to a B. Raise rents from $830 a door to $950 a door, and a lot more information in there that I want to get to the questions first. So let me see. Mike emailed in. He says I have a background in accounting and a finance and finance as a CPA. I still need my 9-to-5 to pay the bills, and I'm wondering should I try to get a job in the industry, maybe as a commercial underwriter or a market researcher, or stay at my current job that I hate, but it has a lot of flexibility with hours and office time. I'm a local – that's the first question. So should you get a job in the industry? Hey, why not? I mean, I remember one of the regrets I had is when I first started out after I left school. I left the band. I left school. I know I wanted to do something. I wasn't sure what it was. I actually became a mortgage underwriter or mortgage – not an underwriter, originator. And I was either going to do that or I was going to join a commercial real estate firm in Boston. And at the last minute, I chose commercial mortgages, the underwriting of the mortgages, instead of the commercial real estate because the commute to Boston, the other job was in the suburbs where I lived at the time, and the commute to Boston for me was going to be a little bit much. Had I taken that, you know, I probably would have been far more advanced, had a lot more money partners, and 5 years out than I was 5 years out at the time. Right now, I really don't care because things are going pretty good. And they've been good. So Mike also asked, should you take a job in the industry? Yeah, that's kind of a catch-22 if you got a lot of flexible time. You hate your job, but you got a flexible time where you can go and you can find apartments on your own as well. I mean, I did well doing it on my own also. I think if you get an opportunity to get into the industry, I certainly would. You get to see the insides and how everything works and how it all comes together. His second question is, he says, I'm a Boston guy. I know Mike. I'm a local Boston guy looking to continue to expand my network. I've noticed that local REAs have been heavily focused on flips and small rentals. I was considering joining the Boston chapter of BOMA or NIOP. What are your thoughts on these organizations, and do you think they're worth membership investment? Absolutely. BOMA is a great organization. NAIOP is a good organization as well. So I certainly agree with joining those. I've affiliated and or joined those organizations at one time, came in and out of them, and still attend different meetings when I get the emails. So that's the real professional. I mean, you go to local real estate investment associations, yeah, they're full of people that are flipping single families and all that. But if you want to be really professional about this, you join the professional organizations as well. All right, I got one more. I got more questions, but I'm going to read one more question that came over via fax before the call, before I open up the questions. So who's my operator on the line today?
Hello there. This is Lilium. I'll be your operator for today.
Okay, Lilium. Thank you. All right, so Lilium's on the line, and she is going to she's going to put you in the queue when you're ready. Okay, so this question is a two-parter as well. It says, I'm making a lot of offers on plus or minus 10 units A-class properties with a purchase price around $750,000, and I'm doing it all cash without investors and without mortgages. I've done some amazing flips in the last year, so I guess he's got some money. He says, I'm trying to use this situation as a negotiating tactic by having no mortgage contingency in the LOI in a short 20-day period to close. The only problem is that most of the time the sellers won't even counter my offer. I base my offer on the NOI and the market rate at which most of the time comes close to the tax value. I have three short questions. Must be a question on the other page, too. I want to offer the full price at earnest money deposit, but I haven't found the guts to do guts yet to do so. I want to offer the full purchase price as an earnest money deposit. $750 as an earnest money deposit. That's interesting. And I feel that it might entice the seller to take a lower price because I'm not going to fall out of contract because of the lack of funding. But the obvious downside is that someone else is controlling a lot of money. Yeah, what's your opinion on this? I think that's a lot of money to put at risk. It might be, it may or may not be a good tactic. You know, if somebody's looking to sell a property and they think they're going to be getting a certain amount for it, and you're way below, then I think putting up a lot of money isn't going to solve the problem. I think the thing is you've got to create good relationships with the brokers, and then you're going to get pocket listings sent to you. That's what will solve your problem. Good relationships with brokers will bring you these properties at a reasonable price that you can close on. Number two, how would you exploit a strong cash position to get a benefit over to others besides having no mortgage contingency? You know, a lot of people don't have a mortgage contingency because, you know, everybody knows how to play that game. You don't tell them, you know, you tell them you're going to be paying cash. You just don't tell them it's not going to be your cash if you don't have the cash. So a lot of people are coming in cash. So it's a strong position, yeah. The only way to, you know, you can offset possibly is, I don't know, maybe you go hard on first, you know. We just put a deal together. We went $30,000 hard at the very beginning to win the deal. So what does that mean? That means if we do our due diligence and we don't like it, we walk away from the deal, we lose $30,000 of the $100,000 deposit. So that's a possibility. They know you're definitely going to close and they get some money up front. You know, what you're really asking me is how to motivate a non-motivated seller who's not motivated by a lower price. You know, you can't motivate a non-motivated seller. It just isn't there. You just got to find people that are willing to sell at a reasonable price, and you do that through good relationships. All right, so I'll go to his third question. Is there a place where it pays off more than anywhere else to make all cash offers on small multifamilies, auctions, foreclosure sales? No. You know, it's just the all cash offer is not going to do it. It's your relationships. This is a relationship business. Relationships, relationships, relationships. The stronger your relationships, the stronger your business. It's as simple as that. That one was from Dimitri. It's as simple as that. There's no, you know, it's great that you have a lot of money and a lot of cash. And there are a lot of people out there that do as well, and there's a lot of people out there that are offering all cash and using somebody else's cash. So that's not your big plus, I guess, for lack of a better word. Your big plus is when you create good relationships with people that will bring you deals. All right, so let's open up the line. Who is our first caller in?
Okay, our first question comes from Scott. Scott, please go ahead.
Hi, Dave. This is Scott McGregor in Austin, Texas. How are you today?
Hey, what's going on in Austin?
Oh, it's nice down here, I'll tell you. It's about 50 degrees.
Hey, do you go to that place that sells the hot dogs there by the parking lot? It's a place that's like kind of like, I think they have music at night. They got all kinds of hot dogs.
I have not been there. What's the name of it? Do you know?
I can't remember. I've been there a couple times, though. But it's like downtown on the outskirts.
Hey, Alex is probably
If you come up from the Bat Bridge, you know, it's about four or five blocks up from the Bat Bridge over a block. It's pretty good.
I'm going to have to go check it out. Yeah.
What's on your mind?
Well, I got a question about buyer's brokers. Yeah. The contract attorney that I want to use is telling me in Texas it's the broker's responsibility to handle the closing, and he doesn't do that at all. He just papers the deal. I was wondering, do you have any thoughts on picking a buyer's broker for the closing? Because I'm a fish out of water with that. You know, as far as doing, like, picking a CPA, doing the attorneys, I mean, that's easy for me. But when it comes to this, I don't really have a framework in my mind.
Your attorney said in Texas it's the brokers that do the closing?
That's what he told me. He doesn't want his name.
I think I've closed like 34 complexes in Texas. That was where my biggest holdings were at one time. And but my attorney out in Texarkana did the majority of the closings, if not the bank's attorney.
Hmm. Okay.
We never use a buyer's broker or a broker
right.
themselves.
Okay.
Yeah, we use brokers to get the deals, but not to close.
Okay, so I'm going to have to talk to a different attorney then.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
That's his impression.
Yeah, cool. That was my question. That's it.
That was it? All right. Go out and get him then.
All right.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
All right. Before we go next in line, I just want to mention a couple of things coming up. We have the San Diego Multifamily Bootcamp coming up in two weekends, and then we have a couple in Texas, one in Dallas and one in Houston as well. And that is in four and five weekends away, or 6 weekends away. Also, we have the Commercial Training Academy coming up, and that is there's a huge opportunity right now in office and retail. And one of the things, the most difficult things, is underwriting an office deal because of you have to use a probability quotient. The probability of renewal, because when they renew an office when they renew an office in retail, if you lose a tenant, it's going to take you typically about 6 months to get another tenant in, and it's going to cost you tenant improvements of, let's say, average $15 per square foot. Okay, so now, and if the tenant stays, there's still tenant improvements, but now it's down to $5 per square foot. So there's a probability quotient, the probability of the tenant staying, which is anywhere between 50 to 70%, usually that's the quotient that you use, and then how much is it going to cost you in the future for these tenant improvements. So those are the things that we go over in that camp. But I'll tell you what, you know, we've gotten three of these commercial deals recently. We've got some more on the plate, and there's a real good opportunity in the commercial markets right now. I love multifamily, still buying them on a regular basis, but always have an eye on what I think office properties were the last of all of the commercial classes to move, and that's why there's such a good opportunity in them right now. So that Commercial Training Academy is in Orlando, and that is in March 18th, 19th, and 20th, I believe. And if you want any information on any of these things, just give Jeff a call or email him at the office, jlindahl@rementor.com or 781-878-7114. Okay, next caller.
Okay, up next we have Dave. Dave, please go ahead.
Hey, Dave, how you doing?
What's going on, Dave?
Good. David Harrison out here in California.
Hey, what do you got? What are you up to?
Hey, I'm dealing with an owner last week who is interested in selling, but he wants to put together a master lease agreement. So, in the discussions we've had, you know, because he wants money down. And, you know, he'll put like a lien against the property for protection and so forth. And he wants a future sales date of like 3 to 5 years. And a couple of concerns I have is, you know, where's the debt market going to be in 3 to 5 years? And then also just the risk factor in doing a master lease agreement. Can you kind of share anything with that?
Yeah. Does he want to do the master lease because he wants to push his taxes off?
Exactly. He wants to defer his taxes. Exactly.
Yeah, of course. You know, the big problem with the master lease is you never have delivery of the deed until you actually exercise the option to take it over. And at what time can you exercise that option?
He said within 3 years he's willing to have us, like, refinance out, I guess, refinance him out or sell the property.
Why doesn't he take a second mortgage?
You know, that's what I asked him, and he said that this is the way he's been structuring his portfolio that he's selling right now, so he wanted to stick with that. And it wasn't really clear on really why, except deferring the tax gain.
All right. So for those who aren't familiar with master leases, it's just like it says. You take a master lease of the property, all the rents go to you. But I've never heard of a seller that's a structure for selling. I've heard of it with distressed sellers. That's usually when it works. But I've never actually heard of a seller trying to do it that way. Yeah, I'd be concerned on it. And how good is the deal?
I mean, it's definitely a good deal, but, you know, it's assuming some debt right now, which is due 2018. So, again, you know, where's the debt market going to be? I mean, it's a good deal now. The numbers work. But in 2 to 3 years or 5 years, maybe they don't.
Yeah, agreed.
So I think it's a pass, but it's kind of creative, and I thought maybe that I'm missing something.
No, and I'm trying. Yeah, and I still don't understand why he's doing it like that when he could go over and just give a second mortgage for the amount as well. You know, why not just get it over with? You're protected because you can get into a 7 to 10 year balloon note. You know, and that will protect you against interest rate increases. Unless you're getting a really
good deal. Is that kind of a red flag that he wants to do that? I mean, that's kind of a weird situation, don't you think?
Yeah, it is definitely weird. I've never heard of it before from that type of a seller. That gives him control. Yeah, I mean, the only way I'd get into it is if the deed was given to an attorney with the instructions that, you know, whatever the option says, when you go to exercise that option, that it's physically delivered to you without exception.
Okay, interesting.
But you have interest rate risk. I don't know what's going to happen with interest rates, especially with China tanking right now, and I think all the economies are going to pretty much tank over the next 2 or 3 years, maybe 4 years. But you never know. Yeah, you know, it's a big what if.
Yeah, I think we'll pass and look at other opportunities.
Yeah, there are definitely secure deals out there.
Oh, absolutely.
All right, well, good luck. Anything else I can do for you?
That's it, man. Thanks. Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you as well. All righty, who's next?
Okay, up next we have Brian. Brian, please go ahead.
Hey, Dave. It's Brian in San Diego.
Brian, what's going on there in San Diego?
Good surf. That's what's going on.
Oh, yeah? You know, there's
really
good
surf, actually.
There's another guy. Is this Brian the surfer that picks me up with the surf?
Yes, it is.
Hey, what's up, man? I was going to say, you know, I know this guy down there that whenever I go down there, I just call him up, and he shows up at the hotel at 5 in the morning with a van and a wetsuit and a surfboard, and we go surfing all morning, and then I have to go teach. So wouldn't it be awesome to have a friend like that? I got one. So
wait,
what's up? How are you doing? I know I haven't been over in a while. You know, I finally got fixed.
I couldn't. Tweeting, so it would be awesome.
Yeah, I finally got fixed. I couldn't jump up on a board. I couldn't do anything for about 2 years, and I'm finally back. So I can do things.
Oh, right on. No,
yep.
I'm ready for you. So yeah, just let me know.
So what's new with you? What's going on? I hear you guys are you got a lot of money.
We're still acquiring, you know,
property
down in Texas. Just,
yeah.
You know, the last year required 150 unit, and then just about 5 months ago, 184, and working on some other stuff. So
nice.
Still doing that, and I just got off the phone with Graciela, so she said hi. And that's kind of what's happening.
Graciela, for those who are listening, I think she started with us in 2006. It's been a while. No, actually, 2006. She's been with us 6 or 7 years, but she's a school teacher. Husband lost her job, comes to a multifamily class, so afraid just afraid of everything, wouldn't get off the plane. You've heard that story, haven't you, Bri? She wouldn't get off the plane when she was the first broker. Yeah. And, you know, here it is. How many years later? She owns like 14 different complexes. Her and Brian have recently partnered together. They're buying deals together. She called me the other day on the phone, and she was saying, what was it? You guys had just gotten like a big investor that they want to buy A properties, A, B plus properties, and how do you underwrite them? Do you underwrite them differently, basically?
Yeah, so that was really my question, you know, and really some ideas about, in a sense, working the numbers, the Holy Trinity, when you're looking at, you know, properties that are built in mid 90s and earlier, you know, newer properties. They have a lot thinner margins, you know, lower cap rates.
Well, the thing is, you know, people that are looking for those properties will take lower yields. So, you know, you just basically go to the money source and find out what yields they're willing to take. I'll give you an example. Like, for instance, we just got a good source of money out in the California area, and they want to place a large amount of funds. So we first, you know, when we first introduced ourselves, we showed them the value-add concept, the emerging market concept, and like it all. And we were showing them, you know, a minimum 8 to 10 plus cash on cash return first year, 20 plus IRR, you know, after the value add. And, you know, they really liked it. And then all of a sudden, you know, as the market's changing, things are getting tighter. There are some markets that are still screaming, and they're in pre-emergence, and there are markets that are, you know, very close to rolling over. So the amount of opportunities, depending on which market you are is different. So, but there are a lot of, you know, in value add, you know, because usually during the cycle, what happens is when a market rolls over, then all of a sudden people realize that they bought too high, and then they walk away from the properties. There's a lot of foreclosures. There's a lot of opportunity. Then properties get rehabbed and brought back online. And in the first stages of an emerging market, there is just a lot of opportunity out in the marketplace. And then that starts getting, as people realize, whoa, there's a market that's really moving, let's jump in and see what we can find. And then after a while, when you get into the seller's market, late seller's market one, then it starts to be slim pickings. So, but it's not slim pickings for the A and B properties that are cash flowing really nicely, but at lower yields.
Mm-hmm.
So we went back to this particular organization and said, hey, look, you know, we know you have a lot of money for for these types of properties, but you have people with an appetite for this type of property at this type of yields. When I'm saying this type of yields, I'm talking 5 to 6% cash on cash return and anywhere from 11 to 14% IRRs. And there's a lot of appetite for that out there because, you know, we go to these family office meetings and, you know, that's what they're happy with. You look at pension funds. Pension funds are tickled pink with a 6% return on their money. So it all depends on your investor and you underwrite to your criteria.
Well, one of the things I'm running into with, you know, more quote-unquote institutional investors, bigger investors, it's almost like our standard, you know, cash-on-cash returns in the typical Holy Trinity where we're delivering 20% IRR. They look at it and go, no, you're taking too much risk. We don't want that. We want a 14, 12% IRR.
Yeah,
so,
exactly. And you'll get people that won't even look at a C+, B- property. They want, you know, they want B+, A.
And they like the look of it. I mean, interestingly, especially foreign investors, they like to say, hey, I own that property. Look how beautiful it is.
Exactly.
Regardless of the numbers.
Yeah, you know, and they're, at that point, they're a lot easier to run, too. I think investors go through, I mean, when you're trying to create wealth, you buy the C's, C pluses, you reposition them, you bring them up to BB minuses, you make a bunch of money. You do that for a while, and eventually you're going to burn out because it's a lot of work. And then you start buying the lower risk, lower problem properties that have lower yields as well. But you got a ton of money. All you're doing now is protecting your wealth, but yet watching it grow.
Awesome. Cool. Yeah, so that's kind of – I feel like we're in that transition, you know.
Yep. It's a great place to be because there's a lot more opportunity out there. You know, when you've got people that are willing to accept a lower yield, there's just a lot more product that you can go after. Not only that, it's so much easier to manage.
Did I lose you?
What's that?
Oh, I lost you for a second. You said I have.
There's
when
a lot
you have
more
people,
product out there.
Yeah.
So when
yeah,
you got people
exactly.
like that, there's a lot more product out there, and they're easy to manage, to property manage. You know, so
yeah.
it's nicer.
Cool.
Good. Good luck.
All right.
Let me know how you make out.
Yeah. No. And I'll see you next weekend. And yeah, definitely. Let me send me a text.
Diego.
If you want to get out.
Yeah, right on.
Yeah, in San Diego.
Okay.
Or in Carlsbad. It's only a few miles from my house, buddy.
Yeah, that sounds good. Hey, remember the time that you took me to the new spot and I face planted right into a sandbar and I had to teach for three
yes.
days with half a face with a big raspberry on it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always tell that story. It's awesome.
All right. I'll talk to you soon, Bri.
Hopefully no smash faces this time, buddy. We're going to get out there.
Right. Absolutely.
All right.
All right, take care.
Catch you later. See ya. Thank you, by the way.
Yep, right on. All right, who's next in the Wisecracker line?
Okay, up next we have Tim. Tim, please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Dave.
Hey, Tim, what's going on?
Hey, not much. I'm down in Virginia.
All right, what's going on down there in Virginia?
Just trying to stay warm and preparing for the big storm that's supposed to be coming our way.
Yeah, we're going to get a piece of that. Should be
yeah,
good.
I know. You guys are right in the bullseye, I think.
Actually, we are. But where we're going skiing, the probability is like 30% that we're going to get the storm. So I'm hoping it's going to keep going north and we'll have some nice skiing in the snow.
Oh, yeah, hopefully get that big old fluffy snow.
Yeah, which we don't see too often in New England.
No. Hey, question for you. Had a meeting yesterday with an appraiser / licensed real estate broker / investor. And he's agreed to come on to our team as both an appraiser and a broker and possibly an investor. The interesting thing is he has property to sell. But we don't have any investors in place right now, and I really don't want to jeopardize the new relationship by, you know, saying, yeah, we'd like to take a look at your properties and then really not have any money to go to them with.
What size are the properties?
Right now, the one he mentioned to us was 168 unit, and that was down in Norfolk, Virginia.
Okay. What's that? I'm not familiar with that market, where it is on the scale.
On the scale of?
where it is in the, on the emerging scale, whether it's emerging or not. I could do some research on it.
Not really. I think it's kind of beyond its I think it might be a little bit yielded out at this point, but there's a lot of turnover. The problem is there's a lot of military down there, and so there's a lot of turnover. It's a, you know, it's a B market.
What's the purchase price?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
The purchase price.
We didn't get into that. I think he was also, we were talking to him really about the appraiser side of it, and he brought up the broker and investor side, and we didn't get too far into that. I asked him if he had a property package. He said he did, but he did not offer to send it to us.
So what's your question?
Well, the question basically is this. We had started in with him as the angle of using him as an appraiser. He brought up the other issues, the other positions he's in. And though we would like to look at those properties, it's a brand new relationship. We'd like to look at those properties, but we really don't have the money lined up. We don't have the investors lined up like this right now because we've only been doing this for, you know, a month and a half. I'm a little behind on getting that lined up. Any advice on continuing along lines of looking at his properties when we don't have any money lined up?
Well, there's a couple of things you could do. Do you have a regular private money program going on? Like, are you doing X amount of meetings a week or getting yourself into social situations every week?
We are in social situations. We have not, and this is where I've kind of fallen behind, is talking to various people that we know that are investors or may know people that have investment experience or money that they want to invest. That I have not been doing a great job on because I've been trying to, one, learn the materials from a new student perspective.
Yep.
And so that's kind of a weak area for me right now. We're trying to get the brokers and get used to all the information and the deal analysis and things like that. But the broker, the investors are actually, you know, they're right here on my to-do list.
Well, you can do one of two things. I mean, you can play along, and I mean, that guy's probably, I don't, well, you could come right out and just say you're not ready to start buying yet. You're still putting your team together and your money team together, number one. That's the straight on, honest approach. The second is to analyze that deal, and while you're analyzing the deal, be out there looking for private money. Are there any investors in your area that you might be able to partner with that you know of?
Very possible. One of the guy that heads up the RIA here, we at the Christmas party we spoke with him.
Yeah.
Briefly, and he is interested in multifamily properties. His big concern is, you know, where. He's more of a, I'll say more of a local investor, not comfortable, based on the comment he made, not comfortable going too far astray, you know.
Yeah, it's a tough situation because, you know, you're in a situation that a lot of people are in. They're just starting out. They're waiting to get their money sources in place. They're not in place yet, but yet you go out there and start analyzing these deals and looking for them. This is a team member. How are you going to use him as a team member? He's going to be the appraisal. He's going to give you market information?
Yeah, actually, my cousins are in real estate appraising, but none of them are in multifamily. And I called one and I asked him for a reference, and he gave me this guy.
Yeah.
And so I called him, and he said, yeah, absolutely, you know, let's get together. I'm going to be up in Richmond. So Paul and I met him for lunch. Based on the premise that we were going to be talking to him about him coming on board as an appraiser, with the possibility that he could give us all, you know, first shot at off-market deals. And then all of a sudden he brought up that he was a licensed broker and an investor, and he had properties. So that's kind of how it really came up, was as an appraiser. That's how we were looking at bringing him onto the team.
When is your next contact scheduled with him?
We just had a meeting yesterday, and I've been sitting here contemplating about contacting about that property he had mentioned.
Yeah. The tough part about this is, you know, if it was in an emerging market, we would be all over it, because we're looking to place a bunch of funds into properties, and we're looking to partner with whoever brings a good deal forward. But the criteria of our money partners is it's got to be in a market that I deem as an emerging market. And from what you're telling me about Norfolk, it's not.
No.
So that's the difficult part of that particular deal. So, you know, you just might say to them, you know, Norfolk's not my market. I'm not comfortable with that market right now. I appreciate the fact that you brought me the property, but I'm not comfortable with the market. And then you continue the relationship. He might ask you what market you're comfortable with, and then you give him the list, and certainly your own backyard, because you use the whatever you can be buying and selling in your own backyard, knowing, as long as you know what strategy you're in. I mean, what cycle you're in to use the right strategy. That's how
okay.
I would approach it. I mean, if Norfolk's not a great market to buy, you don't want to buy there anyways. Right?
Right.
I think he pretty much yielded out, and he's not going to give some – unless he's giving you a really good deal, and I don't know why he would do that, unless he's distressed for some reason and he hasn't said it, probably not something you're going to buy anyways.
Yeah, probably not. And of course it got me curious, because I really want to take a look at the property. Because I don't know the exact address. You know, I can go to RE Indicator and look at, a general area. And the problem with Norfolk is this block is good. Two blocks over is sketchy. I think that's kind of the way it is maybe in many cities.
Yeah. Those are your choices.
Okay. All right.
If it's not your market, if you don't want to buy there anyways, it's not your market. I would just explain that to them. But then get out there and be working that private money angle. Nothing's going to happen without private money, that's for sure. But doesn't mean you don't start looking for deals as well, because usually in a good market, if a good deal comes up in an emerging market, we're definitely, it's 150 units or above, we're the resource. Come to us. We're looking for deals all day long.
Okay.
All righty, I got to move on.
All right. Yeah, thanks, Dave.
Sorry, to you, Tim. All right, who's next? Who's our next caller?
Okay, up next we have Brian. Brian, please go ahead.
Hey, Dave, this is Brian in Orlando, Florida.
Hey, Brian, what's going on?
Hey, 52 degrees, we're doing great. How you doing up there?
That's pretty sweet. It's like five below.
Yeah, ooh.
That's cool.
Anyways, hey, I wanted to get your take on assignment of contracts from a broker. This broker said he did not want to do the deal. I'm not really comfortable with his answer in that he says, well, we just got done purchasing a couple other projects, and we just didn't have the money to buy it. I ran the numbers based on their agreed-upon contract. It's a 296-unit complex. Actually, it's two complexes for 296 units at $12 million. And the Trinity works, no matter how we break it down. $75,000 earnest money deposit on the assignment, and they're asking for 2 points.
They're asking for 2 points?
I mean, I thought I didn't sign it, but I could sign it and maybe ask for 1 point. Their assignment ends at the end of this month.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I would definitely ask for 1 point, but when's that point paid? At the time of assignment?
No, it would be at the time of closing.
Hmm. Okay, so what's the question?
The question is, well, have you purchased assignments of contracts? I'm a little bit skeptical as to why they're assigning it. If it's such a good deal, because the numbers are looking good, we've got about a 12% cash on cash, 1.7 debt service, and 8.2 on the cap rate. The buildings are built in 1985, 1988. My desk review, everything looks copacetic. I just don't have the full deal. So my question is, have you done that, or what's your take on assignments of contracts? Is there something more I should be skeptical about?
My take on assignments of contract is the fact that sometimes you get so busy and you've got your buying machine in full buying mode, and all of a sudden you realize it's like, uh-oh, we don't have the bandwidth to take on more deals, but yet more deals keep coming in, and that's when people will start assigning. So I don't have a problem with getting an assigned deal, but, you know, you got to do all your due diligence to make sure the thing checks out. Have you been to the property?
I have not been to the property yet, but I've done a lot of extensive research from my desk. The property is about 5 hours from where I live right now.
All right. So I think if everything checks out, you know, you negotiate that assignment fee, get it signed, you know, spend a day up there, start checking out your comps and all that, and make sure that everything's in order, and walk the exterior of the property, you know, determine what you think needs to be done in repairs, and then see if you still got a good deal. And if you do, charge.
Yeah, I mean, we got 2 weeks left, so I could have boots on the ground within a couple of days and get a good. I've got contractors up there as well. To sweeten the deal, $9.1 million of it is assumable.
That's good, but so what's the purchase price, did you say? Did you say it was 12?
$12 million purchase price, 9.1 assumable.
So you're going to have to raise
3.5 plus assignment, maybe 4 million.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's good. But, you know, when even though it's assignable, they're going to check you out, right?
Of course. And that adds into, if you don't mind, I have one other question. They did say, you know, come on in, you can do it. And once the banks check you out or confirm that you're a viable buyer, which that's right. And I spoke to my sponsors. One sponsor turned it down, another sponsor. We have one more question to answer for them. But that's pretty tight. You know, if you're trying to move relatively quickly, it's difficult because you have to stop and say, hey, Mr. Sponsor, will you help me? Can you qualify for these assumables? I'm running into a little bit of a one step forward, two steps back in trying to solidify.
That's the way this business is.
Absolutely.
All the way. It never changes. You know, there was a deal that we're trying to close last Friday, and it's like, it just should have closed and it didn't. And there's just so much, you know, there's just so much goes on in these deals. Every deal is different. So
are you finding the sellers to be flexible?
Find what?
To move those. Are you finding the sellers to be flexible to moving their closing dates if you don't quite make it? Or what I thought was put this under contract, sign the assignment contract, and once they show that we're real, get the sponsor on board, then they would be more negotiable to extend the deadline of our earnest money deposit, give us more time to get up there and do some due diligence.
I would be getting the sponsor on board now. I wouldn't wait and just let them know that, you know, this is what I think I got. I got to do my due diligence to make sure it is what it is. And therefore, you have that. The assignment, I mean, when do you have to close after the assignment? Well, the bank's going to check you out. You know, on a assumable, it's a minimum of 3 months. The bank's going to take to check you and your sponsor out. You know, minimum. Those things close between 3 and 5 months. All the deals I've ever done on an assumable, which I've done about five or six of them, and they've been 5 month closes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's good news.
I don't know why it takes so long. Yeah. I don't know why it takes so long for the banks to check out the new borrower, but just so everybody listening knows that when the bank does check you out on an assumable, they're checking to make sure that you're as strong as the borrower, and you don't know how strong they are, but the bank does. They want to make sure you're at least as equally as strong as the borrower that you're taking the place of, number one. And then number two, the reason that we're talking about a sponsor is, you know, typically if you've got a $12 million deal, it's a $9 million loan, you need to have a net worth of $9 million to qualify, and you need to have liquid assets of 10% of that, with $900,000 or $1 million. So if you don't and you run into a good deal, well, you get a sponsor that sponsors you through it. You know, you usually have to do that one or two times at the beginning, and then you buy in your own deals. You don't need a sponsor anymore, and then you know, a few years later, what we see in our students is they start sponsoring other people's deals. So it's something that a lot of people go through this process. The first few deals are your hardest deals to do. Once you get those first few deals done, man, it's just like you won't believe how busy you're going to be.
This is my first one.
Yeah, good.
scaring the heck out of me, but it's all good. It's all good.
Yeah, it's good to be scared.
What do you think about outside of Atlanta, surrounding Atlanta area for a type of, I don't know if it's necessarily an emerging market, but
I like Atlanta.
For growth.
I like Atlanta for the next couple of years. I'm headed down there tomorrow, actually. To take a look at it. I'm going to take a look at some older sellers that are like in their 70s and they want to sell off a couple of their properties. So I'm taking a ride around and checking it out with another student,
nice.
Actually. Yep.
Nice. Well, thank you for your time.
Hey, my pleasure. Good
appreciate
luck.
It. Have a good one. Yep, thank you.
Okay, who's next?
Okay, up next we have Danny and Desiree on the line. Please go ahead.
2-for-1.
Hey, Dave, how's it going?
Good, how's it going?
Good, good. Desiree stepped out the room, but I'm here. I'm also in Orlando. I'll get right to it. I just wanted to ask you a few questions. I'm looking at, I became a member of the National Apartment Association.
Yeah.
And they have a designation called CAPS, which is Certified Apartment Portfolio Supervisor. Have you heard of it, and what do you think about it if you have?
Yeah, I like that. I mean, I think NAA, National Apartment Association, is a good organization. They have a big convention, huge convention every year in June. They've got good information on how to manage your apartments, and if you go through one of those programs, you'll certainly be a very astute manager. IREM has a program as well, the Institute for Real Estate Management. They've got the ARM program and the Certified Property Manager, CPM program,
mm-hmm.
as well. So I think anytime you can get additional education, do it.
Awesome. Awesome. Okay. Another question that I have is we're looking – I noticed you mentioned on one of your other calls about billing back the tenants for the cable and basically owning the cable and selling it to them as another income stream.
Yeah.
And we have an option on the property we just purchased where we could buy the equipment and pay for the receivers, et cetera, and we could bill back the tenants. In the first year, we're basically going to break even, but in the second year, we could be making about $18. If we sell it for 30, we could be making about $18 in profit per
yeah.
apartment. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, I know that you did it on a bigger unit. Ours is only 24. Is it a good idea?
Yep. Yeah. You're increasing your cash flow. That means you're increasing the value of the property. So yeah, that's a good idea to do.
Awesome. Awesome. Okay. Just a couple other questions. We're looking at properties, you know, consistently. Should we be looking at properties built in the 1950s and 1960s, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the big question is, when was the last time it was repositioned? You know, if it's been repositioned, you know, recently and everything's been updated, good. If not, you know, you get a lot of old components in there, not good.
Okay. Not good. All right. All right, and the last question I have for you, Dave, is emerging markets. Do you know of anything in Florida, or how do you?
Pensacola is one of the fastest growing cities in Florida. That's a good market. We bought one there last year. It's performing really well.
Pensacola,
and I also like the area between Cape Canaveral and in Jacksonville. That whole coast area there. Job growth is projected at 14% next year for that area.
All right. All right, man. Well, thanks, Dave.
All right. Hey, thanks for doing that. How they did that. I appreciate that.
No problem. Anytime. We hope to do a few more deals so we could do it all over again. It was fun.
All right. Sounds good. Good luck. Take care.
Take care.
Okay. Who's next?
Okay. Up next, we have Ed. Ed, please go ahead.
Hey, Dave.
Hey, Ed.
So, Dave, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your experience with buildings with subsidized living, if you still consider those type of properties and the pros and cons.
Yeah, there's several different types of subsidized housing. Down south, they have this thing called LORA. There's FHA that has different subsidized housing. They get a bunch of different programs. But basically, the whole idea is, let's say there's a big difference between and there's also, what do they call those, tax credit properties as well that are subsidized housing. So here's the difference. This is what you're looking for. You're looking for a subsidized program that's going to end sometime in the future. So usually what happens is the builders get some sort of a tax credit or benefit for a building, but in order to do that, they've got to make a portion of their unit subsidized, maybe even the whole complex subsidized, and then for a certain period of time, and then after that, and it's usually 15 years, or 10, and then after that, it can go to market. So the real play is buying properties that have the ability to go to market within 1 or 2 years after you buy it, because you buy it based on the subsidized rent, and then now you go to market rent and you can make a pretty good windfall. The other thing is a program like LORA is the fact that it doesn't go away, and there will always be a certain amount that have to comply with LORA. You really got to read through the documents. You have to be in compliance or you'll lose it. They won't pay you, and all of a sudden you got a bunch of tenants that have to be moved out. And you've got to be watching. We had LORA in a couple of different properties down in Texas, but the good thing was is that the wages were increasing so fast down there is that LORA was paying, close to what the wages were. So we didn't really lose out that much. But you've got to really take into consideration the pros and cons of a program that's going to stay over the long haul.
Okay, that's great. And I had one other quick question.
Yep.
In your offers, do you have any contingencies that require you, that basically are contingent upon you receiving financing for the remaining 75-80% as well?
Yeah, there's always a financing contingency on there on our larger properties. So we have it. So we only offer all cash for properties that are like 20 units or below. But the larger properties, you offer cash because the question is, are you paying cash or are you going to assume it? So that's the question in the seller's mind, anybody that plays this game. And then when you say you're going to offer all cash, then they want to know what type of financing you're getting. And then you explain the financing. Otherwise, you're doing a 1031 exchange, and you really don't want to expose that at the offering period because then you're negotiating from weakness because of those time frames. So I forgot the question. Sorry. I was thinking about something else. Some other thoughts dropped into my mind.
Probably got the pats on your mind like me. I'm local,
you know it.
So. I was just curious, about the contingency of, once you have a deal in place, the contingency of receiving the actual financing, because I didn't know if that was something that would scare a seller away, but I know you can obviously be burned by that as well if you have a deposit in place and your financing doesn't come through.
Yeah, no, in the larger deals, there's always financing contingencies. And it's usually, it goes right side by side with your 30-day due diligence, or sometimes it's a 30-day due diligence, 45-day financing contingency, and a 60-day close. So it all depends on the deal. But it's very, very common in the large ones. But the small ones always offer all cash and don't tell them where you're going to get the money. But the way you protect yourself when you're offering all cash on the smaller deals is you put a contingency in there that the subject property has to appraise at the purchase price. And if you're getting financing or hard money, it has to appraise for them to give you the money, and that's really the biggest thing. You've got to qualify, of course, but, it's got to appraise out. There's your contingency.
Okay, great. Thanks for the info.
All right, right on. Brace yourself for the storm.
I know. It's way too cold around here.
I'm talking about the storm of Brady blowing through Denver on the way to the Super Bowl. Super
that's
Bowl 50.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's good. That's going to be a breeze.
Absolutely. All right. Take care. Okay, who's next? Who's next in the Wisecracker line?
Okay, up next we have Roger. Roger, please go ahead.
Hey, Dave. Roger from sunny southwest Florida. It's cool here. It's only like 58 degrees. But,
ooh, going on down
cool
there.
For us.
Bet nobody's at the beach.
Nobody's at the beach, nope. Christmas break, we managed to close two modest-sized multifamily. So now I feel like we're starting all over again. But
What'd you do?
We closed one Christmas Eve and one New Year's Eve, actually, in Central Florida.
So what size property?
38 units. So now we're starting all over again. Well, at least we feel like we're starting all over again. Out of money, et cetera. My question is mobile homes. We looked at a mobile home park. If we could possibly believe the owner's figures, it's just an amazing, 30% cash on cash return. We don't really believe his figures, but I wonder if you just have any advice for somebody sort of looking at mobile home parks for the first time.
You analyze a mobile home park just like you do apartments. We have a lot of people leaving apartment houses, which is boot camps, going out and doing mobile homes. Sometimes those returns are crazy, so don't look the gift horse in the mouth. Put it under contract and then do your due diligence, because you'll get your money back if you decide to walk away. If the numbers aren't what they thought, what they seem to be.
I guess the trick will be to verify what he claims the rents are, because it just looked too good to be true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Put it on the contract. Move forward. You know, let the property prove it's no good, you know, before you decide. Just get that thing on the contract.
Thank you.
That's all right. Helpful. Good luck, Roger.
Thanks.
All right. Who's next?
Okay. Up next, we have Betty. Betty, please go ahead.
Hello?
Betty.
Hey, Dave. This is Betty from... Good. I'm good. How are you?
Good.
This is Betty in Connecticut, and I do have a question, but I just want to put a quick plug that I am working the Cincinnati market and looking to explore partnerships.
Betty, are you a Pats fan or a Giants fan? Because Connecticut is like a tweener state, you know?
Yeah. I'm a don't-watch-any-football type fan.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No problem.
So what's the wind howling up there? Are you in Boston today?
Yeah. The wind is
terrible.
Windy day.
You don't sound happy. Anyway, my question actually is about something you had mentioned earlier in the call. You mentioned pre-emergent markets. So I was curious about pre-emergent markets and also markets that are just starting out on their climb up. I was wondering if you could name some of those markets for me in both categories.
Cincinnati's one of them. St. Louis is another. There's like four or five of them. I can't remember the other three. But certainly those two.
Are pre-emergent or just starting?
They're just the same thing. Pre-emergent is just starting. It's pretty much the same.
Oh, okay. But you don't remember the other two?
I can't remember the other three, especially three of them. I can't remember them off the top of my head.
Okay. All right. That's my question. Thank you.
All right, Betty. Good luck.
Okay. Have a great day.
You too. Okay. Who's next on the line?
Okay. We have no further questions at this moment.
All right. A couple of things. Usually the call is about an hour. I know we had a couple of different groups on the call today, so I was willing to go longer if people wanted to go longer. The Commercial Training Academy. So if you're a mastery student on the line, that is going to be in Orlando, and that is going to be March 19th to the 20. I mean the 20th to the 22nd, I believe. No, wait, I was looking at May. It's the 18th to the 20th. Excellent event. You want to go learn about that. If you haven't been to Multifamily Millions, you definitely want to go to that as well. We got a bunch of those coming up. But the Commercial Training Academy, we only have planned once this year. It's in Orlando, so you want to give Jeff a call at the office to get yourself confirmed. 781-878-7114 or jlindahl@rementor.com. So get you space for that. If you are not mastery and you don't have a package like that, then you want to be there too. So get a hold of Jeff. He'll tell you how you can get in there. Couple of things. Your homework, as always, is to go out there and get yourself into two networking situations. Get yourself into two situations where somebody asks you, what do you do? So you can say you're a real estate investor who invests in emerging markets, blah, 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 and pique some interest and then move the conversation forward if they're interested. And if they're not, you know, move on to the next conversation. So that can be any social situation or you go to business meeting groups. Yeah. By the way, meetup.com, you can be doing two or three meetings a week. I know Dave Hicks out of Texas, one of our mastery students, he was doing two or three meetings a week. Actually, he got up to seven just so he could be practicing his pitch. He was nervous as hell going out there and, you know, in networking and meeting people, and he thought the only way to get over this fear is to go out and do it. So he just looked and he found all kinds of meetings to go to, some real estate, some financial, some wine tasting, one was an equestrian event, figuring that rich people would be there, and he's doing really, really well right now. So you do what you have to do at the beginning to get you over the hump. There's always the beginning's the hardest part. The second thing is you gotta get two offers in every week. They don't have to be deals that work, that necessarily kill, you know, great deals. They just have to be offers so you're in the game, so you're talking to the brokers. You know, so there's a dialogue going on. So you're comfortable doing it. So, and as you do more and more of it, you become more and more comfortable. And before you know, one of those offers, it's going to get accepted. And that's going to be a great thing, and then life's going to change dramatically. So that's your homework as usual. Do that. I will be on again in 2 weeks for another Tuesdays with Dave. Nice being with everybody. Good luck out there. Go Pats on Sunday, and take care, everybody.